Good morning. Pleasure to be back in Jacksonville. I've been having a good weekend, been speaking a number of times around the city, and just loving it here. I spent four very formative years in Valdosta, Georgia. I graduated from high school there and graduated from college there. I finished college in 2 years, went on to Emory Medical School. But those years, last 2 years of high school and the first 2 years of college, are very formative, powerful years. So I love this area of the country. I've been practicing medicine for 10 years. And I felt something stirring in my heart. And I heard this word, sabbatical. I didn't really know what it meant, but I knew it was used in the scripture, and so I went to look in the scripture. And sure enough, in Leviticus, it talks about the year of sabbatical, taking a year off and not planting your field. It doesn't give a lot of instructions about what you're supposed to do. It just tells you what you're not supposed to do. You're not supposed to work. And since I have a Jewish background, I thought, wow, I've never thought about taking a sabbatical. I want to do that. The sabbatical was always a big leap of faith. It takes a lot of faith not to plant your fields. In fact, it says at the end of Chronicles that the Israelites were taken captive because the land had not rested for many, many years. So they were told to take this sabbatical year. They were told to take a year off and not plant their fields, but it's hard not to plant your field when your neighbor's planting his field. So I essentially quit my job, and I went to South America. My plan was to learn to pray for healing. I was staying in youth hostels. And when I left, I left in July, and I was planning to return the next July. So I had books that needed to be keeping. I had to pay my taxes at the end of the year, and so I left my office computer in the charge of a woman who had been keeping my books, and I paid her $500 for any expenses that would come up for her to take care of those. It was about December, and I sent her an email to say, how are things going? Are you able to, put the books together so that we can get them to the accountant in January? Well, I didn't receive any email back. And I was at another internet cafe a couple of weeks later in Bolivia, and I sent her another email. Now it's January. I didn't hear anything back. Now I'm getting sort of anxious. Here I am. I'm going into prisons. I'm going into orphanages. It's really costing me to do this work, to pray for people. And essentially, I am teaching people to forgive. And as I help them to forgive, and this is some of the toughest situations with orphans, with prisoners, it's dangerous for me, and it's uncomfortable for me. And I'm expecting that somebody that knows me would want to help me. This woman was referred to me as someone who went to their church. She was a single mom. And now it's later in the year, and I'm writing another email, and I'm sort of angry now. And I find another woman who said that she would take care of the books. So I said, if you would just send the accounting over to this other woman. I got an email a week later from the other woman. The books arrived. I said, did the $500 arrive? She said, no, there was nothing. And so I sent another email to Polly, the bookkeeper, to say, please send the $500 on so the other woman can take care of this. I heard nothing. I sent another one the next week. And I got an email back, just a short sentence. It said, "I'm keeping the money as a storage fee. Stop harassing me." And I wanted to reach through that screen of the computer and strangle that woman. I was so angry. I was so incensed. And it was one of those offenses, especially from, it's even worse when it's someone in the church, isn't it? You're expecting to be treated like Jesus would treat you, someone who knows your heart. She knows what I'm doing down there. How could this happen? How could she have betrayed me, rejected me? And this is pushing all of my buttons. But there I am teaching people to forgive in South America. And I cannot forgive this woman. I can forgive her for about a minute and a half. And then it's like Velcro. It just comes back and sticks to me. And I try all the tricks that I know. I'm saying my prayers of forgiveness. I'm trying to push it away. And as I try to pray through this, it's one of those things where you get blender brain. It just keeps coming around and around. You may be able to get it away for just a little while. And as the days go by, maybe you get half an hour of peace, but it comes back that this person. And when we are rejected, when we are betrayed, it is interesting to understand why. What is it about that person? Why have I given that person power to set my value? You see, I'm a neurosurgeon, so I have this huge facade that is supposed to say I am valuable. But someone has pierced that veil, and for $500 is willing to let the relationship with me go. So all that I have been doing to try to build up my own value, my own validation, my own security in life, this woman, she's just disregarded it. And that has happened to most of us in this room with one relationship or another. You've given someone your heart and they have treated it in a contemptuous way, or at least not valued it. We feel incredibly incensed. They probably are well justified or really don't think much about it. Handling those kinds of rejections, those kinds of betrayals, it's easy to become a victim. The victim mentality starts with hopelessness or helplessness. I'm helpless. There's nothing I can do. It also focuses on the person that hurt you. You notice what they're wearing. You know where they work. You know their schedule. Essentially, it's a form of idolatry. You start to focus on them because you're so angry, but it draws you into hoping that something bad happens to them. It essentially controls your mind. You watch their every move. But I think the worst thing that happens with the victim spirit is the perception of moral superiority. That I perceive myself, I would never do that to someone else. And we don't often have the compassion. It's sort of focusing on the bad guy versus the good guy. And we don't see ourselves as part of the human race. Essentially, Jesus is the only one who is able to do life perfectly and is morally superior. And when we have this moral superiority, it actually is very harmful to us. It feels right. It feels good. We're well justified. Well, when we are betrayed, when we are rejected, most of us want comfort. And so we go to the refrigerator. We find our chocolate, or some of us it's alcohol. It can be whatever it is. We try to find comfort. Or we have some well-meaning friends who say, "Oh, don't worry about that. You'll get over it. You'll find another friend. You'll get another bookkeeper. It's not a big deal. And they don't know how to grieve with us, that this is a loss. Because most of us in our families have never been taught to grieve. We're taught, hey, shake it off, get over it, stiff upper lip. And so we try to help our friends the same way, and we don't have that. The thing that Job's friends had with him, at least the first week, they sat with him and just grieved with him before they tried to assign blame and figure that out. So before we go to comfort, the comfort generally doesn't work if we haven't been validated, if we haven't gotten validation. Does somebody understand how I feel? Does somebody understand why this has bothering me? Well, she's just your bookkeeper. Who cares about her? She's really not someone valuable. Or tries to explain it away. Do you understand why this is hurting me? I trusted her. And I believe it's important when we are betrayed or rejected to go to God first, to try to get our validation. Are we able to journal? Are we able to talk to God? God, do you understand? Have you ever been rejected or betrayed? Do you know what that would feel like? Oh, he does. How about that? He actually knows exactly what that feels like. And most of us forget that because God is sort of away from us, far away. You know, through this process, it led me to look at Jesus' betrayals, right? Peter denies him. It says Jesus looked at him across the courtyard. He knew exactly what he was saying. Best friend. Calling down curses on himself that he never knew the man, just standing some feet away from him. But the person that really intrigued me, and I've never studied, was the person of Judas. And so I want to go through some things with you today that I found interesting, and you may or may not agree with me, but let's take a look at this character of Judas, because most of us love to think about Judas as a black-hearted, money-grubbing monster. And that's what the name Judas essentially stands for, treachery in our culture. But I love psychology, I love personality studies, and I want to look more closely at this character to see, is he anything like us? So the first thing that didn't make sense to me for this black-hearted monster is in Matthew 27. Starting with verse 3, then Judas, his betrayer, seeing that he had been condemned, was remorseful and brought back the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, I have sinned by betraying innocent blood. And they said, what is that to us? You deal with it. You see to it. Then he threw down the pieces of silver in the temple and departed and went and hanged himself. But the chief priest took the silver pieces and said, it is not lawful for us to put them into the treasury because they're the price of blood. And they consulted together and bought with them the potter's field to bury strangers in. So how do we explain this? If Judas wanted money, and that 30 pieces of silver was enough to buy a piece of land, why did Judas not buy a piece of land or take a vacation in Italy or go to the coast? Why does he take the money back? Obviously, I'm looking for motivation. What happened here? Judas' character is actually more complex than we realize. Black and white is easy for our brains. We love black and white. We love evil. We love good. We know where to put them, where to file them. And I want to shake this up a little bit, and I think this Judas character does that. We love to fit people into our neat categories. So let's go to John 12, verses 1 through 7. Very interesting passage. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, whom Jesus raised from the dead. So they gave a dinner for him there. I'm in the ESV version, John chapter 12. Martha served, and Lazarus was one of those reclining with him at table. Mary, therefore, took a pound of expensive ointment made from pure nard, and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair. The house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But Judas Iscariot, one of the disciples, he who was about to betray him, said, "Why was this ointment not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?" He said this not because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief, and having charge of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was in it. Jesus said, "Leave her alone, so that she may keep it for the day of my burial. For the poor you always have with you, but you do not always have me." Interesting passage with Judas displaying a bit of his character. But let's talk about that. Let's talk about who was Judas. So first of all, his name wasn't Judas. Judas is not a Hebrew name. Judas is a Greek name. His name was Judah, as in the tribe of Judah, because Judas was from the tribe of Judah. And Iscariot means he was from a town called Kerioth. And we read back in Joshua 15, when they name the villages of Judah, they are assigned when the children of Israel come to the promised land. This is one of the cities in Judah, that the cities that Judah is given. So Judas is from this town, which probably explains why he was so trusted as the treasurer. He was from Jesus' own tribe. They were very tribal back then. He was one of the brothers. He was from the tribe, very trusted, potentially a businessman, we don't know. Certainly more trusted than Matthew the tax collector. You wouldn't trust him with the money bag. So Judas, or Judah, was part of Jesus' own tribe. Now it's actually interesting that in the verse just before that in Joshua 15:24, when it's listing these villages in Judah, it also lists a village called Ziph, Z-I-P-H. And any of you students of the scripture and students of King David when he was running from Saul will note there was another betrayal that occurred. The Ziphites went to Saul and said, "David is hiding among us here in Judah." And most of us don't recognize from those passages in 1 Samuel that the Ziphites were from David's own tribe of Judah. And they went to Saul to come and get him, hoping that Saul would give them some reward. So he's carrying the money bag. He's trusted. So what were his responsibilities? So every day, Judas, now, not everyone had a money bag, right? They didn't have wallets. So when Jesus goes to the woman at the well and tells the disciples to go buy food, who's going to pay for that? Judas. He's carrying the money bag. He's going to buy food for all the 12. So morning, noon, and night, Judas is buying food for the 12 because they're not carrying their own money. And probably because he's carrying this money, and this money is heavy, he feels justified in taking some of it. I mean, he's doing the tribe quite a bit of service here. I would even say probably like some of us, when we're on the job, we might feel justified in maybe using the company car for our own expenses or taking some office supplies, or you fill in the blank. This is the way it works. We do service and we want a little something back. So he makes this announcement about Mary's perfume. Interestingly enough, he says this in front of Jesus. So Judas has some authority in this group. I mean, Peter actually pulls Jesus aside to correct him. You notice that. But Judas corrects Jesus out in public. And I think both Peter and Judas potentially thought Jesus was just a bit naive. He just didn't get how the world works. But both Peter and Judas, and I will submit to you the rest of the disciples, didn't like the way things were going. They asked Jesus to teach them to pray, and one of the things was, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done." They wanted the kingdom to come. That's why they were in this group. Judas was not the only one who wanted the kingdom to come. James and John, in fact, had their mother go to Jesus to see where they would, if they could sit on his right and left. They'd been looking at the throne catalogs to see where they might stack up in the new kingdom. See, they loved power. All of them were looking for that. They wanted to call fire down from heaven to destroy the Samaritans, men, women, and children, because they didn't accept Jesus to stay there. I was raised in a family where the man was the king, the father was the king, and everyone served him. Whatever he said, that's what went, whether it was true or not. And I know that's a very popular family of origin style in the Middle East. Perhaps it is here also. And so when we're little boys and we grow up, we can't wait to get into the power structure so that we can make the rules and make things happen. And we all know that money allows power. So I don't believe Judas just wanted 30 pieces of silver. He did want that 300 denarii. That's a year's wages he saw Mary anointing Jesus with. Now think about that. That actually wouldn't fit in his money bag. He would have to take that to the bank now, wouldn't he? He'd have to invest it, maybe some stocks, options, futures. I mean, I'm not sure what he could do with that, but that would really start this little 12 movement moving forward, trying to get this kingdom to come already. It had been 3 years. Judas was upwardly mobile. Now, Jesus did warn Judas. He said, when he was washing the feet in John chapter 13, verse 9, Simon Peter said to him, "Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head." Jesus said to him, "The one who has bathed does not need to wash except for his feet, but is completely clean. And you are clean, but not every one of you." For he knew who was to betray him, and that is why he said, "Not all of you are clean." He's giving Judas little warnings. Because I will submit to you, I'm not sure Judas saw what he was about to do as a betrayal. Even this word betrayal is in the English, but it's not in the Greek. It is the word paradidomi. It is to give over. And it can be used in a positive or a negative sense. In fact, in Matthew 11:27, this is Jesus speaking, "All things have been handed over to me by my Father, and no one knows the Son except the Father." That's handed over is paradidomi. It's the same word we use for betray. It's not quite as clear. I want to go to John 13 again now in verse 21, "After saying these things, Jesus was troubled in his spirit and testified, 'Truly, truly, I say to you, one of you will betray me.' The disciples looked at one another, uncertain of whom he spoke. One of his disciples, whom Jesus loved, was reclining at table at Jesus' side. So Simon Peter motioned to him, 'Ask Jesus of whom he was speaking.' So the disciple, leaning back against Jesus, said to him, 'Lord, who is it?' Jesus answered, 'It is he to whom I will give this morsel of bread when I've dipped it.' So when he had dipped the morsel, he gave it to Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot. Then after he'd taken the morsel, Satan entered him. Jesus said to him, 'What you are going to do, do quickly.' Now no one at the table knew why he said this to him. Some thought that because Judas had the money bag, Jesus was telling him, 'Buy what you need for the feast,' or that he should give something to the poor." See, John is writing this. First of all, we learn that Judas was giving something regularly to the poor at Jesus' request. This was a common thing he would do. But the fact that John is writing and says nobody knew, I think John's even saying, even though Jesus just told me, I didn't even know. I couldn't believe it. This was the farthest thing from my mind that Judas would do that. Otherwise, John would have said, he's doing what? He would have run after him, and it would have said, and I, John, ran after and tackled him and said, don't do it. He said, no one at the table knew. It's just so confusing. Why would Judas? I think it's also confusing because Judas was not the only disciple that really wanted this kingdom to come. It's just that Judas had a plan to make it come. He went one step further. They all sort of wanted their bit of this kingdom. But Judas took it a step further. You see, they all wanted this showdown. Jesus, every time he'd get with the Pharisees, and you'll read about these encounters, it says, and they wanted to arrest him, but he escaped. Meanwhile, they're all watching Jesus do these incredible miracles out in the little towns. And they're saying, a guy with this kind of power should be facing off with these Pharisees and not running away. We've got to get this movement underway. And Judas, I believe he has a plan to get Jesus and the Pharisees to face each other. It's sort of like having a football star in your hometown, but he will only play at the small colleges. You see this basketball star, but he's only playing pickup games in the alley. You've got a superhero, but he won't do anything about the bad guys. He's out feeding the poor, feeding 5,000, walking on water. But you know he has the power to bring this kingdom. And you're tired of waiting. And you've been waiting for 3 years. And by the way, a guy with that kind of power, why is he sleeping in the open field in the Garden of Gethsemane? Why isn't he in a hotel? Isn't it time, Jesus, to get this show on the road? I think Judas thought he was doing Jesus a favor. I believe he thought he was doing him a favor, which to me explains the kiss. I mean, why would you have to kiss him? If he really hated him, why didn't he club him himself or just point to him? I think he thinks, finally, Rabbi, we're going to get this scene we've all been waiting for. You are going to do what you're supposed to do, and we're going to get this kingdom moving. You see, even Jesus' brothers wanted a showdown. It says in John chapter 7, after this, Jesus went about in Galilee. He would not go about in Judea because he knew the Jews were seeking to kill him. Verse 2, John chapter 7. Now the feast of booths were at hand, so the brothers said to him, leave here and go to Judea, that your disciples also may see the works you are doing. For no one works in secret if he seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world, his brothers told him. They all want to see a showdown. John 14:22, Judas, not Iscariot, said to him, Lord, how is that you will manifest yourself to us and not to the world? So John chapter 18. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples across the brook Kidron, where there was a garden, which he and his disciples entered. Now Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place, for Jesus often met there with his disciples. So Judas, having procured a band of soldiers and some officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, went there with lanterns and torches and weapons. Then Jesus, knowing all that would happen to him, came forward and said to him, whom do you seek? They answered him, Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus said to them, I am. My version says, I am he, but in the Greek it is I am. The same thing he says earlier in John chapter 8 when they pick up stones to stone him because these words are the words spoken with Moses. And here it is. When Jesus said to them, I am, they drew back and fell to the ground. That is the power that Judas was waiting for. That's what he wanted to see. Now the power's coming out. Now we're getting this show on the road. At his word, they fall down to the ground. But we all know that's not what happened, is it? They got up from the ground, and then Jesus went with them. And when Judas saw that, he was remorseful. He returned the money. He was looking for the priest, the chief priest, to help him with his guilt. They weren't going to help him with his guilt. So we see Peter handling his betrayal, his denial, in a different way than Judas did. Peter wept bitterly. He hung in there. He humbled himself. Judas was unable to do that. A friend of mine did a case on a 30-year-old woman who had a brain aneurysm. And there was a new device out that covers aneurysms and treats them. And he wanted to use the device. He wanted to be one of the first people to use the device. And this 30-year-old woman had an aneurysm that he thought he could treat. Now, the aneurysm was small. It was really on the small side of the type of aneurysms we treat. But you see, as a physician, we have a bias. He wanted to treat that, and so he did. She came back to his office 2 weeks later. When you put these devices into the brain, you have to give them blood thinners. She came back, and she was sitting in the office waiting room at her follow-up appointment. Successful treatment, everything went well. She grabbed her head, and she collapsed. And she had a bleed into the brain in his office waiting room. And people know I have faith, and so they talk to me about these issues, and I felt it difficult to suggest to him, did that woman need to be treated? What I'm talking about is, did she need to be treated right then? Oftentimes we can wait. We can see, is that really the best treatment? And what I'm suggesting is that a betrayal is doing something to someone that you would not want done to you or to your family member. As physicians, we face that all the time. Most of you think that doctoring is black and white. It's not. There's a lot of decision-making, and physicians also have a lot of bias. He decided to treat this woman and felt guilty about it, which was the reason he was talking to me, because she probably did not need treatment, at least not right then. He wanted to use the device. He gets paid for doing the surgery. He did a procedure. And I found it interesting that she collapsed in his waiting room, not at her home or not on the street. It was almost making the point. It's almost like God is trying to tell you something. But in all of our professions, whether you're in law, whether you're in business, whether you're whatever we're doing, we always have the ability to bend the truth a bit. Maybe save a little money, maybe deceive. And I get it. Save a little something on your taxes. But I want to look at this word betrayal and say, are we listening to what God is saying to each one of us? Or are we just trying to get what we want, trying to get our program going forward? He wanted to treat that woman. He wanted to be efficient with that device, but he made a choice that if it had worked out, everyone would have been happy. But I believe that God was telling him not to treat that woman, and I've felt that same tugging of the spirit, and I'd have to say I've made the same mistake. When I think back, thinking that probably shouldn't have been done. It probably didn't need to be done right then. So I just invite all of us to, I want to give you just a moment of silence to see what God might say to you right now about rejection, about betrayal. And are you doing anything that might be categorized as betrayal in any sense to what God is telling you? So give me a minute of silence right now. beautiful thing is that God is always willing to forgive. And however small we might see these little things that we do in life, our little white lies, our little corners that we cut, He wants our whole heart. My point is that we are a lot closer to betrayal, and Judas is a lot more like us than I am comfortable with. But instead of responding like him with suicide, which, by the way, when the stock market falls, we see that happen all the time. When people's dreams crash, people kill themselves, unfortunately. Because Jesus isn't the center. Their program is the center. And I believe that Judas had some concern for Jesus. That's why he was remorseful. But he didn't have him preeminently, and that's what he wants. And Peter went through the humbling aspect and was able to be forgiven. When I got back to the United States, I gave Polly a phone call, and I said, she picked up the phone, and I said, "Hi, Polly, it's David Levy." Click, phone hung up. Ouch, it hurt again. That anger came back. How dare she treat me like that? Those of us who go through rejection, the other aspect that we can do is we can say, "Father, this hurts. Do you understand it?" And then, "I'm willing to forgive. What is it that I'm really missing from her? If it's respect, would you send me someone else who might respect me? If it's a bookkeeper, I need another one of those. If it's a relationship that you lost, Father, you can send that any way you want because that person is not able to give me what I want." And so I also encourage you in this season and even this day to move forward in forgiveness, letting these things go and trusting your good Father, very good Father, to give you what you want that person to give you. I want to bless you now with the Hebrew blessing from God told Aaron to bless the people with. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. And lift up his countenance on you and give you peace. Thank you.
Our sending hymn is number 312.